This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway, wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Hey guys, before we start, a quick shout out to Alpha Dog Nutrition for sponsoring this podcast. Alpha Dog products are now available at dusupply.com, and you can use code ALPHADOG15 at checkout for 15% off and a credit for free shipping to try it yourself. Now let's get you to your podcast.
Welcome to my podcast, where we are going to talk about a lifestyle with dogs and throw in a few life lessons along the way. Whether you're a hound hunter, bird dog enthusiast, running setters, pointers, retrievers, or a flat out running dog junkie, this podcast is for you. I am your host, Heath Hyatt, a certified law enforcement canine trainer with over 3 decades of personal and professional training and handling experience. It's time for me to pay it forward. So grab your leads, lace up those boots, and come and join me on this lifelong process of teaching, training, and learning. Do you like to be outdoors like I do? If so, unlock the wilderness with Onyx Maps. It is your ultimate guide to exploring, hunting, and conquering the great outdoors. With detailed maps, real-time tracking, and exclusive access to public and private lands. Onyx Maps is your key to adventure. Discover the possibilities and never get lost again with Onyx. So subscribe today using the promo code K920, letter K, number 920, and know where you stand. We're on. All right, guys, if you want to expand your knowledge in dog training, and especially in hounds, you know, you've heard me talk about it on podcast. Like, I take bits and pieces from everybody. It's like a buffet. I take out what I like. I stick it in my toolbox. And even though I don't like it, I may have heard it or I may need it down the road, but I take out what I like and I use it. So we are going to the man himself. And we got Nick Adair on from Middle Tennessee. And if you guys have caught this, he's got a podcast, got his own channel. He's got Gun Dog It Yourself. And there is a commonality here. Most people that we have on, even some of my police trainers, you know, we had Jeff Shetler on. He started hunting hogs with dogs in California. You're going to hear, Randy Hare will be on. Randy Hare started running beagles. And that's what got him introduced into the police world. And he switched over. And Nick's got the same kind of story. So, Nick, I'm just going to let you roll with it. Just tell us a little bit about you, and I definitely want to hear about them old yellers again.
Well, Heath, I appreciate you having me on. You know, the intro is probably a little overblown. I don't know about being the man in anything, but if anything, I'll take the claim of just being a very genuine, curious person in the dog space, and kind of like yourself, I'm very open about what it is that I talk to everybody from across the world in the dog space, and I'm just after everybody's cheat codes. It doesn't matter if it's bird dogs, police dogs, hounds, I don't care. I think that there is more crossover than what I think a lot of people would suggest or admit. And, you know, we all have our own little echo chambers. We all have our own little flavors and preferences, but at the end of the day, dogs are dogs. And you can learn something from anybody that interacts with dogs on a daily basis. And so, you know, kind of what you're talking about, what got me into the gun dog world a long time ago, you know, I started out in the coon hounds. I had the red bone coon hound, and, you know, kind of echoing the what I grew up with, you know, what you're in school. The teacher says, let's read Where the Red Fern Grows. So I'm not even going to try and church it up at all. I fell for it. You know, I was 7 years old and I ripped the binding off that book. I just ate it up. I was that kid that was my favorite book. And I said, one day I'm going to get me a red bone. And fast forward, you know, a decade or so, what have you, get back from boot camp. I did the Army Reserves. And the first thing that I did was go get my own red bone coon hound. And then spent a few years not knowing what the heck I was doing, but I was in the woods doing something. And, you know, we scraped a coon out here and there. We scraped a possum out here and there. But, it's a time that I wouldn't replace for anything in the world. Before we hit record on this, I was telling you, like, I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for hounds. I have to do the occasional check-in. I try and get out at least once a year and get a good night hunt in, just to kind of harken back to the good old days. But I kind of fell out of it because, like so many people, I realized, you know, sleep is kind of important, and you start adding in family and work, and it just, the lifestyle just didn't really work for me. So I transitioned into bird dogs and pointing dogs specifically. And now I'm just ate up with the pointing dog and bird hunting world.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what you hunt, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, when you start building that bond with an animal, you know, i.e. the dog, like it changes hunting. You're really not the one hunting. You're just taking the dog hunting. The Absolutely. Dog is hunting for you, right? Like, you know, and that bond to the antis and the non-dog loving world, which I don't know how you can not be, but you know, it's, I mean, there's no greater thing than having a partner that, you know, does the things that our dogs, and I say dogs because I'm running hounds, you're running pointers, you know, that they do, and being able to take them out and see how their genetic code and their makeup get, they do things because it's their natural instinct and they love to do it. Like, that's just something that a lot of people don't get to experience like you and I.
100%. I was just having this conversation with some buddies last week. We're out on the road and we're chatting, and, you know, I got one buddy in particular. He's just one of those guys. You probably have a couple of them that you're buddies with that, I just call them killers. Like, they just, no matter what it is, no matter what the game is, where you go, they just, it's like they just have a bloodthirst that I don't even have anymore. You know, maybe when I first started, you know, we talk about different seasons and stages for hunters. And maybe when I first started, like I was a little bit more just go get them kind of attitude and really hunted hard. And I hunt hard. Don't get me wrong. But to your point, it's for something different now. You know, if you take my dogs out of it, you take my pointers out of it, I can't say I'm necessarily going to be out in the woods, at least for sure, not to the degree that I currently am or doing without those dogs. And, you know, a buddy's dog, friend's dogs, they can kind of fill the void, but there's nothing like being out doing what it is that you and your own dogs want to be doing. That there's that mutual kind of goal or destination that you guys are chasing, regardless of the game. It doesn't matter. I mean, I've seen this to where obviously, you know, your pack guys, your hound packmen, and then, but your bird dogs and your tracking dogs. And I mean, just fill in the blank. People love their dogs. And we all have our special hunting partners, maybe our kids or grandkids that we go out in the woods with, but the dogs are, it's the conduit between all of those hunts. The only other thing in common of you being in the woods every single time you go out is you're going to have your dog with you. And you can't say that about any of other hunting partner or buddy. It's something special when you get to share in those moments, and you actually get, when you're lucky enough to actually bag the game that you're after. Like you said, there's really no greater feeling, in my opinion. And I think that's why I look back on it. I'm like, man, part of me wishes I still had some of that bloodlust, that bloodthirst that some hunters have. But also, I think it's made me a better dog man and at least more in tune with my dogs to the goal kind of transitions to where it's not just about bagging the game, but it's about how you go about getting that success and bagging the game.
You know, as you was talking, I was just sitting here kind of thinking, and I know somebody's probably said this before, but like, we're the only hunters with dogs that can go hunting without a weapon.
Yeah.
Right. Like, our training season, I carry a big stick, you know, walking tall, like,
yeah.
Oh, what's his face? You know, I carry a big stick, you know, I don't, even when season's in, I'm guilty and I get fussed at all the time because I very, very, very seldom ever carry a weapon with me, because that's not what it's about. You know, a dead bear to me is useless. Like, I want the dogs to run and to trail and to tree and to bay. I want them to do all the things that they love to do. And, you know, as you were sitting here talking about that, it just like the light bulb went off in my head. Like, ding, ding, ding. Like, I don't, as a hunter, you know, if, are we even categorized as a hunter? Because we're hunting, but we're not taking. And me and one of my good friend, Wes, we had this conversation the other day, you know, about when we were younger, we were probably those people that had, you know, that look in our eye, like, you know, we're out here hunting, like whatever we catch, we're taking. And,
right,
you know, I am not, like, I'm 20 years removed from that. A good 20 years removed from it. When I got really focused on the hounds and started understanding what I was trying to accomplish and what I wanted and what I enjoyed, all of that went away. So, you know, he said, well, we've gotten soft. Yeah. I mean, I guess I've gotten soft, because that's not about that for me.
Yeah. Oh, 1,000%. And I say that all the time to people that ask me, you know, when they start comparing themselves as like, you know, every subsection in the dog world likes to pretend like they're the hardest hunting or the hardest dogmen or the most loyal, I should say, to their dogs. And I'm real quick to correct them. And to your point, it is the houndsmen, because y'all are the ones doing it night after night without any sleep, regardless of weather. You know, I mean, heck, some of the hunting you guys do, y'all are looking for the worst weather that you can possibly have. And then y'all go do it. Y'all see the animal. Y'all take it in. Y'all take the dog singing at the bottom of the tree. And then you just load up and go. So you can spend days out there chasing a big cat or something, finally find success, and be perfectly content just leaving it behind. And I'm not going to sit here. I don't think I know a single bird dog person that's going to go out and see their dogs after a long, long hunt, miles underfoot, see their dogs point a bird and say, okay, that's it, and heal them off and leave. No, they're going to go flush the bird and shoot it. And until some bird dog people will say and follow up that they will watch their dogs point the birds and then leave, I'm sorry, like the people that do it truly for just the dog work and the enjoyment of the time spent with their dogs in the woods, it's the houndsman, you know, 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah. Well, and you something else you just brought back up. I was going to say a minute ago, and then I lost it, and then you brought it back up. Like, when you say we do it just for the dogs, by the end of season, I'm tired. I'm wore out. I've been getting up every day at 4 a.m., and I'm like, I only got a week left, man. I got to do it for the dogs. I got to take, like, you know, I've got to get the dogs out. Let them get their last 5 days in. And I'm literally like just beat. I'm done. And in my head, I have to do it for them. Like, yes. And maybe that's my excuse. I don't know. That's my excuse for getting out of bed and pulling my boots up two more times. But yeah, I mean, I do it for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many times a dog gets us off the couch when we, again, back to your previous point, you know, we may have gone soft. I like to think of it as just comfortable. You know, you give a man something soft to sit on, some warm food in his belly. You know, he's pretty comfortable. He doesn't have to go anywhere. But I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting on that couch like, man, I really should go out. I at least run the dogs, like, you know, even if not train them or really work with them. And I always end up doing it to some regard, because I always go back to, you know, these dogs, we don't have them for a long time, right? You know, let's just call it a decade roundabout. You know, we all know the dogs that we lose too early. We know the dogs that kind of stick around too late, but let's just call it 10 years that you get some really good prime time with that dog. Every day that you literally just don't go spend time with your dogs or go let them run and get some fulfillment or express themselves and just, you know, chase something or point something or what have you, fill in the blank. Like, that's a waste of day. And to me, like, we have, you know, a lot more time on this earth. And so the amount of time that, like, we are comfortable just being like, you know what, I'm going to be lazy today. The dogs, now it gets me off the couch almost every single time. And, you know, you do it for the dogs.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And just kind of reiterating what you said earlier, like, I don't know that I would spend as much time in the woods without them.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'd spend some time on the water.
Right.
In the boat.
I'd be fishing. I'd be picking up that fishing rod a lot quicker. But the dogs is what got me off that boat, right? Like, the dogs,
that's right.
It's a year-round thing for me now. And every year I say, I'm going to start fishing a little bit more. And every year I'm like, no, nope, I just go a little full bore into dog training, you know, be it for a test, trials, specific hunting trip or whatever. I never seem to find the time for fishing anymore.
Yeah. Well, because of our season here, you know, 3 months out of the year, it allows me in the summer months, you know, of course I like the musky fish. I think maybe we talked about that, but, you know, I start up, you know, March and April, then turkey season rolls around. I try to get in the woods some, and then I'm still fishing a little bit. I'll make a trip or two down east, run my dogs a couple days down there. And then, you know, June and July, they're dormant because we can't. Mm. And then August starts up. So that gives me that allows me a little time to fish. So that's my excuse anyway. But while we're talking about training, like, you have interviewed several people that I would love to interview and several people that I have interviewed. And, Nick, I just wanted to talk about, you know, what are some things, let's just go into some training stuff.
Yeah.
Tell me your philosophy. Tell me the stuff that you've picked up, and you can name, you know, whoever. They can all go back and watch it or listen to your stuff and listen to those interviews, because I find it very interesting when we cross-reference, like we said, on some of the stuff that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when it comes to training, I'm a little different than the average person. You know, I was like everybody when I first entered the world. You have no idea what you don't know. Like, you don't even know the right questions to ask. You don't know who to ask. So you're just out there asking everybody, and then you're taking everybody's advice, and, you know, a fraction, if any, of it actually works. And then, you know, what little does work, you get super excited. Then you get a big ego, and all of a sudden you think that you're the world's biggest dog trainer because you trained it to sit or whatever. I started my podcast with some buddies because I couldn't find the quote unquote mentors, right? To at least give me the quality information that I was searching for. And so, like, I was really just kind of in a corner training the dogs the way that people in my local area trained them, which was fine. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that none of them had any good dogs. They were fine, but there was just something more. And so I got to where I was asking everybody. I was after everybody's cheat codes, and I don't care how you train your dog. I really don't care, because at the end of the day, if it works for you, then keep doing it, right? Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I'm also that type of guy that I believe that there is always a better way to do things. There's always something to improve. And so I can sit here and go talk to anybody in the dog space and take at face value what they're giving me and find the value in it. But I can also start seeing some of the questions or holes within their system. And it's not to pick on their system, because let's face it, some of these systems and methods and processes have been around longer than me. Mm-hmm. But I'm one of those guys. I'm more of a conceptual thinker, right? Rather than a step-by-step person. You know, people are built a little different. Some people just want that step-by-step program or recipe. I need to know why we're putting whatever the recipe is calling for in the pot. Like, that's just that's my makeup. It's always been that way. I suck at remembering details and names and dates and all that stuff. So the technical stuff, the details, just kind of gets lost in translation unless I wrap my head around the entire full concept. And so when I'm interviewing all of these, let's call it, I mean, some of these people have just been legends within the bird dog space, and I'm interviewing them, and I'm not ever talking to somebody to try and poke holes in their system. I'm trying to find the commonalities, the common threads. Why does it work in your program? And then why does that program and method work over there? And to me, that's where the best information is it's not the differences between the methods and how people prefer to do it, but the commonalities. You know, what is the Smith method over there doing the same way as the West method over here versus George Hickok's over there? And then, you know, there's all kinds of different things that you can look at. And then if you start finding those commonalities, to me, that's a great place to start for anybody trying to figure out how to train their dog. Is if you find all of these trainers that at least in practice agree with what they're doing, then, you know, you can't really argue with that if everybody across the board is doing it. And then you can kind of get lost in the little minutia of each program or each trainer from there on out. And you know, then it just turns into a preference thing. So ultimately, to sum all that up, is like I've really found myself to where I try and focus on the principles of dog training and the foundations more so than the how-to. I figure if you focus on the principles, you focus on behavioral learning and theory for the dogs, then you can more or less make up your own path forward. You don't have to rely on one person's recipe, because I find it interesting how so many people will sit here and say, you know, every dog is different, but then try and train every dog the same exact way.
You know, I was going to ask you, and I know you got more to say, but I actually wrote it down. When you say that, like, each dog trainer, you know, has their own way, and I believe this, I say this, and like, I've got some training groups. In fact, like you said, I was taught a one way by locals when I first started. And when I got into the law enforcement side of it, I trained with a certain group that was run through the state. And what I learned later on in life is the reason that that method works is because it took a certain style of dog to fit that training regiment. Mm-hmm. Do you see that?
Absolutely. I see it not only in the dogs, but the people as well. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, just like I was talking about, you know, I'm a conceptual thinker. Some people are more technical thinkers. So a system is going to make more sense to certain people, and while another system or method makes sense to someone else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it kind of goes into where you're kind of trying to line up the process or the method with the person, but it also has to fit the dog as well. And so, you know, you have some dogs that have higher drive, some dogs mm-hmm. that are lower drive, you know, some, there are some dogs out there that, you know, are more or less called soft. You know, that word has kind of developed a different meaning in my head over the past few years. The more I become knowledgeable about this, it's, you know, don't get me wrong, there are, you know, quote unquote soft dogs out there, but genetically speaking, if what we've been doing for generations and decades of producing these dogs and intentionally designing and pairing certain dogs up for certain characteristics, the genetic components are there. And so I think a lot of dogs that are labeled soft, they're labeled that way unfairly. I think a lot of those dogs are either more intelligent than some handlers are used to, or they have a different style drive. And I think that's important for people of all corners of the dog world, whether they're hounds or bird dog people or what have you. Different dogs have different drives, right? Some dogs, you know, pack drive means a hell of a lot more to them than ball drive. You know, ball drive for some dogs is like the end all be all. They couldn't care less about me as the handler, as long as I'm holding mm-hmm. that tennis ball or Kong. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you build in your food drive, and then it's like there's four or five different drives. And so, you know, if all you do is you go follow a recipe, then you might get lucky and you might get the dog through it. And I think the majority of the methods out there will eventually work on the vast majority of the dogs, but that's not to say that it's the most efficient way forward, right? Like you might get the dog that you're wanting by the end of it, but if it takes you two or three times as long with two or three times more reps than another version, I would say that, you know, it's kind of an unnecessary burden or time frame. And back to what we were speaking about earlier, we don't have that much time with the dogs. So I would rather come at when I'm going into a training field with my dogs, I want to feel like I can anticipate what the dog's thinking and why. Right. Rather than how. Like, let's just go set up a scenario because I read it in a book. And then let's just see what happens, right? Will you find success that way? Eventually, these dogs are smarter than what I think a lot of people give them credit for. And just by repetition, they're going to learn through classical conditioning. But I would rather set the scenario up and be like, all right, my dog, this particular dog really, really has a high food drive. So let's give some reward-based system. Then meanwhile, I have another dog that couldn't give a crap about food, especially in the field. She doesn't care. But you know what? She's a crackhead when you throw a bumper, or when you have a tug or a bite pillow or something like that, to where I have three different dogs myself, and each dog I handle and reward, if you want to call it that, in a completely different way the same day in the field.
Yep. No. And it's that reward value for that dog. When you're talking about all the different rewards, the reward holds different value for different dogs, for sure. And thankful for me, when I'm dealing with my hounds, most hounds are food driven. I can do a lot of, I don't have a hound on my lot that could care less about a toy.
Right.
Right. Now my police dog, I can work him a little bit with food. When I'm doing my OB, my low drive stuff, my low stimulation, like when I'm doing obedience and stuff, yeah, I can work him with food. But when I put him into that prey drive, like that stuff means nothing.
Yes.
So yes.
And what's really interesting in that is, you know, you just talked about food drive, play drive, and prey drive. What is really a lot of fun and kind of addicting for me is when you start channeling those drives, when you can transition drives, and when you start understanding what makes your dog tick, you can actually increase the perceived reward of anything by overlaying it with anything else, right? Like, you know, this is it would solve so many problems of people like, well, my dog loves food, but it doesn't love the tennis ball. Okay, well, it only gets food if it goes through the tennis ball. Right? Like if you really want to create value in that tennis ball, you can create and you can build that dog's drive. Somebody listening to this, like, well, how does that help me tree more coons or find more bears or whatever? Maybe you need a little bit more prey drive in that dog. Maybe you had a dog that was suppressed because it was just too young in the pack. You know, there was, you know, it just didn't stand out. It didn't get the opportunities to get its mouth on enough fur, right? Well, maybe in a year or two, instead of saying it's washed up, it never created the prey drive. Well, if you do have this item over here with food, like you're talking about, we can overlay to where he only gets the food through the fur. And so maybe you're not out that dog yet. Maybe you just need to reignite that fire a little bit. And maybe you have a good, you know, coon skin and you let him play with it, tug on it a little bit, then it gets its food, right? Mm-hmm. You mark it. Food. And I'm not going to sit here and say that it's worth your time to do this with every single dog. But if you're sitting there scratching your head, looking at dog, like, I don't know where I went wrong with this. Genetically speaking, this dog should have been better. Like, well, let's unpack that. And why do you think that it would have been better? And then let's, you know, play it back in our heads. How did our upbringing and the opportunities and exposure get us to this point to where maybe we do need to do a bit, you know, bit building drive within that dog, or at least direct it in the direction that you want the dog to be going to. Does that make any sense at all?
Oh yeah. And I tell people all the time when we're talking about drives, you can build drive through frustration.
Yeah.
You know, you was talking about, like, you know, giving them fur, like, don't give it to them. Like, you may need that dog that, like, you need to let that dog see everybody else getting to play at the party.
Yeah.
And they don't get to have part of their pack animals, right? They want a part of what everything else is doing. And
yeah,
I've told people numerous times, and I'll just give us one specific example is, you know, the dog don't want to stay at the tree, or he don't want a tree. You tie that dog back, everybody else gets a part of the reward, whatever that reward is. And you do that two or three times. I done it with a plot dog that I had, Louie. I had a dog named Louie. Dog was a phenomenal trail dog. He'd trail into the tree, and he'd give out the prettiest locate. He'd switch it over, and he'd chop for just a second, you know, 30 seconds or so. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. On to the next one. And, you know, old-timer told me, tie him back. Don't let him have it. Now, he didn't have the knowledge you and I have as far as, like, the training stuff. He's like, tie him back. Let another dog have it. Don't give it to him. It took me eight times. And that dog, you could have blown dynamite up at the base of that tree. That dog wasn't moving. It wasn't moving. So frustration. We built that drive through frustration. And I tell people that all the time. And they look at me like I'm crazy.
No.
No.
Back tying a dog, making it. if they can't get to it and they want it, and to your point, mm-hmm. if there's pack drive and they see that other dogs want it and they can't get to it, that's just mm-hmm. going to build that desire. And, you know, we talk about like opposition reflex. You know, what do you do if you, what happens if you go to PetSmart or whatever, fill in the blank, and you grab a dog harness instead of a flat collar and a leash?
I know exactly where you're going.
What's that dog going to do? It's going to pull you.
Drive into it.
Just like the sled dogs, you know, that's, there's a reason why they wear them, to pull.
To go, go, go. That's what they're for.
And so, you know, if you look at the police dogs, you know this better than I do, but for to create more value or perceived value at the target, what are you doing? You're holding that dog back, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes just getting a dog frustrated at that, it's going to allow them to express that drive into whatever the target is. And so, you know, some people, it kind of goes contrary to like our natural instincts and how we think about things. Is if we want a dog to care more about fur, then we need to, you know, we need to let him play with it more. He needs to see it more. And I'm like, man, do you want to eat, you know, pick your favorite food. I don't care what it is. You know, I'm a big steak guy. I can eat a ribeye steak almost every single night. But you know what? After 30 nights of eating ribeye steak, you know, I might not mind, you know, a chicken or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you can get worn out on that. And, you know, so many people in especially the bird dog space, I haven't seen it because I haven't been around it as much in the hound dog space. You can overwork and overtrain your dogs. I don't care how high a drive it is. You can easily overwork your dog to where just give them a break sometimes. Yeah. And then it's amazing how take a week off and it's amazing how they come back reinvigorated. It's like they just needed a vacation, which we've all been there before. But I don't know why people think that their dogs, the answer is to do more and more and more. Sometimes take a step back and do less.
Oh, man, I've been screaming this. I've been screaming at Nick like, hallelujah. Like, you don't know how many times I've told people, just put the dog up.
Yes.
Put the dog up. You get burnt out at work. And, yep. You know, we really get into this with the competition hunters that's hunting those 6, 7, 8, 10-month-old dogs that are puppies. They still got to be a puppy. You know, yep. They got to be a puppy. They've got to have that time. And, you know, when you're hunting them 6 nights a week and you're expecting, you know, X, Y, and Z, your expectations are plumb off the chart. Like, I mean, I've told people, I tell them this all the time, just put the dog up, put him up for a week, 2 weeks, you know, and I'm going to roll that into getting hurt or having a bad experience. Like, put them up and let them forget about it for a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. Like, give them that vacation. Like you said, we get burnt out at work, man. There's nothing when I take off for the month of December and I hunt for the whole month, like I'm rejuvenated when I go back to work. Like, I've got it out of my system. I'm good.
There might even be a little small part of you that may want to go back to work. Like, it's familiar. Well,
I'm really tired by that last week. I'm kind of begging the dogs. Y'all done.
Yeah.
But yes, like I'm screaming it from the rooftop. It does not hurt to put a dog up for a spell.
Yeah. And that's not to say that you don't go exercise them or whatever, right? Like, just do something different, right? It, you know, if you're banging your head trying to do something in the field day after day after day because you're developing it and you start seeing your dog resenting it almost, go do something else. Go put the dog on a leash and go walk down the street. You know, go run them, go whatever it is. You know, I actually just got back. I had the fortune of going down to Oklahoma and I visited with Delmar Smith last week. And one of the best tips and advice he gave me, and he said that he's been saying it for decades. Obviously, the man's almost 100 now. Yeah. I think he's 97 right now.
Wow.
So, and he's been training since it was either 6 or 7. So, you know, 80 plus years of training dogs. And the best tip that he could provide was, if you're having frustrations or issues with your dog doing a certain task, go train it a parlor trick, something completely irrelevant that you don't care about. That's a party trick that, you know, if you want to train your dog to go get you a beer out of the fridge or whatever, it gets your dog thinking, it keeps them fresh and stimulated. But it's through a completely different channel. And then by the time you come back to it, you had that vacation from the frustration point that brought conflict between you and the dog. But it's going to be amazing how just taking a week or two off to go, you know, still put time and energy and effort into this over here. But then you come back, it's amazing how like the dog's going to come back and they've like read the training manual or something. And all of a sudden they're magically doing what you couldn't get them to do a week ago. Sometimes just hitting reset and redirecting them a little bit is the best thing you can do for your dog.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't say it more and I couldn't say it better. Like a lot of, sometimes we need that reset. Sometimes we need that vacation. Sometimes we need that time away from being burnt out. And you, like you said, you keep asking. And when they don't get it, you get frustrated. And then more times than not, we're doing more damage to that training scenario or that foundation work. You know, you and I both are big on foundation work then.
And your relationship with the dog. Don't forget that.
Yeah. So.
Attention hound hunters and outdoor enthusiasts. Are you ready to experience the thrill of fair chase hunting? If so, check out Southern Hound Hunting Magazine. It's your ultimate guide to all forms of hound hunting. Starting in the flat woods of southern Georgia and covering vast terrains across the nation, we bring you genuine stories where the chase is exhilarating as the catch, recipes, and the brag pages that follow. These adventures will take you down memory lane. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a newcomer to the sport, if it's hound worthy, we've got you covered. Join us in this heart-pounding world of hound hunting. To subscribe or to buy the latest swag, go to southernhoundhunting.com. You can also follow along on Facebook and Instagram where the hunt never ends. Get ready for the real fair chase experience when you join the pack here at Southern Hound Hunting Magazine.
So what are some things that stand out to you that you've learned through interviewing some of the guys that you've interviewed that maybe you wouldn't have used as like a training method or a scenario, anything that kind of stands out, like a learn, like that aha moment, like, why didn't I think, I have those all the time. I'm like, why didn't I think of that? Like, duh.
Yeah. The biggest one I could give anybody that took me years to figure out is isolate the behavior. Okay. And what I mean by that is you can't go out there and train your dog and everything means everything all the time. Okay. Mm-hmm. Isolate it. Care about what you care about, and anything that you're going in the field that you didn't set out to say, I'm going to train this or I'm going to address this. Don't care about that at all. Like The only thing that I would care about is if you've trained something like an obedience command up to a certain standard that it is now an expectation. Like if you don't do this, then, you know, heads are going to roll. Obviously maintain the standard that you've developed, but don't let something get in the way of your actual goals. You know, it, me coming from the bird dog world, it's just easier for me to translate this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is so many people, when they want to go and work steadiness in the field, you know, they go and plant the birds and they have the setups and the scenarios exactly right with the wind direction and all that. Well, then they come up and they want to work steadiness, but they can't get out of the way of the obedience before coming to the line, right? This is one of the most common errors in bird dog people. And again, this is the training field or testing or trialing, but they will just start harping and nitpicking the dogs, whether it's a heel, a whoa, a lay down, a sit, whatever it is, you can pick your poison here. And the dog becomes so frustrated because he knows the dogs are smart. They know what they're going in that field for. They know what they're about to go do. And, you know, we call it, you know, suppressing or capping the dog's drive before you even get going. You're stealing that dog's drive to where you, from the moment you got out of the truck to the edge of the field, you're just constantly on the leash, you know, pulling back on the leash. And then we get to the field and you unclip the leash and you say go and the dog's not wanting to go. Well, what did you just do the last 50 yards leading up to the line was yanking back on the leash, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say you can't open them back up after they get some motion going and stuff like that. But what the biggest thing that I learned was isolating behavior is if you go out wanting to work a certain thing, work that certain thing and everything else will get its own day. But for now, I'm working on this one thing with the dog and you will see just leaps and bounds on your progression. And again, you can't go out in every training session, be a full entire process every single day. It just, it doesn't work that way in a dog's brain.
I mean, you're just like, you are hitting the nail on the head of stuff that we've either discussed or I believe sometimes what we're asking our dog to do is so complex, just like you're talking about, that you have to single out that behavior if you want to work on that behavior. And I'll tell you where I learned this, and I'm going to give this in the law enforcement world. So we were doing building searches, and the object was to get the dog to bark at the door or where the room that the person was hiding in, right? Yeah. So let me just set this up for everybody visually. So for a building search, and I'm just going to use a house, okay? So we would breach the door or the door would be open. We would go to the threshold of the door. We put the dog in the down and we give our commands, you know, police department, come out, show your hands, yada, yada, yada. If you don't come out, let yourself be seen, you're going to be bit, right? So we give our announcement. So that's like a preparatory command for the dog. When the dog hears, you will be bit, he knows, like, it's on like Donkey Kong, like, yep, it's game on, right? All right, so we give these commands. We give the dog a second to send inventory. We want him to take in all the odors, and we need him to go find the odor of the person that's hiding. So then we send him into a search. So he goes from coming up to the threshold to being calm, cool, collective, taking in odors, and then we send him into the building, and then he has to do a search of the building. And then he may search a bedroom and a living room and a hallway, and they may be in the bathroom. And then he's got to go to the bathroom. He's got to work that seam around the door. And then the dog needs to alert us by, i.e., digging, scratching, barking was the goal for that day. We need the dog to bark at the door. It just needs to bark one time, right? One time. We're asking for baby steps.
Yeah.
So I had Franco Angelini was with me. He is a world-renowned canine trainer. He used to be called the bite doctor because he could work your dogs, get grips on them, get them doing all the things X, Y, and Z. So we set up for this, and we send the dog in. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, we're going to do a building search. He's like, but that's not what you're asking the dog to do. I'm like, huh? He's like, you want the dog to bark, right? I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, why are we doing the 15 steps to get to the bark?
Yes.
We are not worried about the search. I'm not worried about the commands. I'm not worried about anything but that dog barking at the door one time. So then he taught me that I got in the hallway. I had somebody standing behind the first door with their foot against it with a small crack. When the dog come by, blowing the door, the dog turns. The dog doesn't say a word or doesn't do anything. Blow again, maybe even crack it a little bit. Get the dog amped up. You know, and when I say amped up, I don't want to use the word amped because I don't want the dog going ballistic, but I want the dog alerting. Loaded. Right. Yeah. So it may take me tapping on the door. It may take me doing, but the dog's got to find me, and I'm giving him my breath. I'm giving him that to take in, and then bam. And then the dog barks one time, boom, we reward the dog. And we've done that like a series of sets of three or four for four or five sets of that. And by the end of that four or five sets, we were getting multiple barks out of the dog at different doors. We would switch the doors. We'd be in the bathroom this time. We'd be in the bedroom this time. We'd be in the hallway closet another time. The dog had, you know, we were moving, so the dog was alerting. So that was my first aha, like, duh, why? Yep. You know, I didn't know. It's like you said, I didn't know what I didn't know. But that's the very first time I had somebody break down the example of one task, one thing. I don't need you doing all this other complex stuff, because that's like the whole game. That's the football game in itself. I need to teach you how to tackle.
Yeah, that's exactly it, is isolating the behaviors. You know, you're not going to go out there and, you know, simulate an entire game, a scrimmage, just to work on a quarterback learning how to pass a certain slant route, right? No, you're going to go in the practice field and you're going to get your receivers and you're just going to drill it over and over and over again until it's muscle memory. Same way with the dogs. And in the bird dog world, it's very similar to where, you know, back to my previous example, they want to go and set up an entire testing scenario for these birds, you know, across a 15, 20 plus acre field, when all we're trying to do is get steadiness on a bird. We've already established and built the hunt and the search and the dog. So we don't need to do that here, right? Like that's a different skill set. That's a different target. We're working steadiness here. So let's shrink the field of operation to where we get higher level of repetition while the dog is still fresh and not concerned about the other search. And you can fill in the blank, whether you're using a check cord or whatever your means are, but you set up the scenario and you get in, you get out, right? It's the same thing. You know, if we want to work out and we go to the gym, we're not going to go do a full body workout every single day, right? Like you're going to pick a body part and work on that. And then the other parts get their own day. It's the same thing in dogs. And so I think we kind of get in our own way. We shoot ourselves in the foot, especially, you know, I really respect the hunt tests and I really respect the field trials. You know, there's pros and cons to every single one. You know, we could spend all day arguing about the merits of any given format or program, right? But at the end of the day, I think so many people, especially in the hunt test world, they think that running a mock test is training, but that's not. The mock test is the test. That's your proofing, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to go do PSA or IGT or any of that other stuff by just repeating that, because A, the format is different every time you guys go out. The scenarios are completely different in the setup. So like it doesn't do you any justice. But then you come into the bird dog world and we kind of generally know the general setup of these items. And so you get people that just they go out and they want to do the full hour long brace on a training day. And it's like, no, go, you will be better off and make further strides and further gains by spending 5 or 10 minutes in the field. Spend an hour. If you're going to spend that much time and effort doing anything, spend an hour game planning your setup and scenario, taking in all the factors of the wind, the whatever, all of the factors. Do that and then spend 5 minutes going through it. You'll be better off with your dog than doing it the opposite way, which is what most people do. And it's just our nature, right? Like, you know, in our heads, conceptually, the average person like, oh, well, I want to work full steadiness on a dog. Well, how do I get to that sequence to where he's pointing a bird? And we hear all the time, it starts all the way back at the truck, right? It depends on how you come out of the truck and blah, blah, blah. And there's certain times and situations for that. Ideally, when you're proofing and testing and you're trying to put all of the behaviors together. But when you're training a certain task or skill set, that's not the time to be worrying about, you know, the dog coming out of the kennel at the truck or healing all the way there. Now, again, if you've established the standard and that's the expectation, don't let it slide. But that's not the time to be working on it. If you don't have 100% heal, you can't ask or request of the 100% heal going into the field. That's done offline. That's done back in the short grass, right? And so to your point, I love that example of barking because, you know, and especially in the working dog field, so many people will get onto their dogs for barking and then go into a training scenario that you just described wanting their dogs to bark, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. it's like, dogs are smart enough you can delineate between that, but you really need that foundation and the principles to be lined up and the dog really understands its job and what it does to get paid and what you want it to do to get paid.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's just, it's layering. You said that word earlier. It's layering the task to make the complexity of whatever you're asking the dog to do. And when you talked about the obedience, my detection guys are horrible, horrible. So most of them are, all of our dogs now are passive. So we used to be doing the sit. So when they got into odor, they were asked to sit. And I, bless her heart, if she's listening, she's going to scream at me. But one of my trainers who trained me, who I got numerous hours under for my master trainer, they still use this method. They run the dog. Dog gets in odor. Dog don't want to set. They pull up on the collar, either push down on the rear end, or they give them a correction to sit. Well, through going through multiple trainings with different people in different fields and stuff, it was brought to my attention that, like, at that point in time, you're doing obedience. You're not doing detection, right? The dog, you're getting on the dog now. You're trying to make him set. So my detection guys were, they don't do it anymore. I tell them, if you're going to work on the set, work on it over here, out of the way, during lunch or after lunch. We're not going to work on the set while we're working on detection. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm changing the game and I'm making it more about obedience. And then the dog wants to start cueing off me. Well, dad's going to get on me. Dad lifts his left elbow up over his waist. He wants me to sit, you know? So they have to separate that. But it's layering those tasks to make a complete, for you guys, for the trial or my certification. I had to certify last week. And you can bet I spent several days working on the obedience part of it. And then the next day I would work on, you know, something else. And then the next day, something else. I didn't put them all together. The dog can put them all together when I'm asking him to.
Yeah. 100%. You know, it's one of those, the tracking scenario. It's interesting now is I go in waves, you know, on what I'm nerding out on in the dog world. And here lately, Randall Likens of Liberty Canine. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but if you're not, I'll link you up. You need to have him on the show for sure. Okay. You know, extensive background, Army Ranger, Canine Kennel Master, you know, he knows his stuff. And so, you know, me and him, we've been nerding out on a lot. And he brought something to my attention a couple months ago that I found really interesting is if you are so stringent on obedience to where the dog is afraid to make a mistake. And if you're tracking that, they're doing what they're called chasing the negative now, right? Like there is, if a dog loses track and it is so afraid to make a mistake because of the repercussions of the handler,
ghost tracking. Yep. They're following.
They're just going to keep going down that track. And you're never going to pick up that they lost the track, you know, 500 yards back. Mm-hmm. Right. You need that dog calm, cool, and confident enough in its job and its task to where if it loses its track, it comes off of it, right? Mm-hmm. And then it can tell you, and you guys can work together to reestablish that track. But most people, you know, while in behavior, the dog does something that we think that it's not supposed to be doing. What do? We come down hard on it. We punish that behavior. So you literally just punish the dog from telling you and communicating to you that it needs to go a different route. It needs to find the track that y'all need to work together. And then they start ghost tracking and all of a sudden they're upset 500 yards down the road because the dog doesn't have the track. And it's just been pretending this whole time, hoping that it was going to pick up the track so as it doesn't get in trouble by you. Right. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes into this is, I've been toying around with this kind of saying in my head and I've been saying it and some people love it. Some people kind of roll their eyes at me. So, you know, take it for whatever it is. But I'm asking a lot of people nowadays, like, do you want a trained dog or do you want an obedient dog? Okay. I don't want a dog that I have to command 24/7. I just don't. I don't want to play that role. I want a dog that, to your point, what you just said, it's learn the behavior. It learns the expectations. And then when you group it together, it knows its job. And he just does the behavior and the job without me having to say and do every single thing, every step of the way to me, like, I want to work in tandem. I want to work as a team. I don't want to have to control him. I don't want the robot dog. It's, you know, some people do obedience so heavy-handed that it takes a lot out of that dog in a number of different ways. You know, we're not talking about just before a specific sequence or scenario. Overall, you've probably seen it to where some dogs, to where, like, when they're puppies, you're like, oh man, this dog's going to eat through a freaking, you know, steel wall. And then, you know, a year later, you're looking at it and it's scared of a butterfly. And it's just like, some people just, they hammer the obedience, and they take non-compliance from the dog as if they're purposely throwing the middle finger up at you. And instead of taking it for what it really is, which is confusion,
so,
right? Yeah. Like, us as handlers, if you're constantly saying no or reprimanding your dog, you have to look at yourself. You haven't set something up right. You haven't communicated it correctly to your dog. And so you're just getting onto your dog unfairly. And then, you know, then we hear it all the time in the hunting dog space. Oh, that dog doesn't have what it takes. It's a washout, right? And it's like, no, you created that washout. I'm not going to say every dog, you know, genetics plays a role in all of this. You have to have the talent somewhere to build off of. But I think there's a lot of dogs that get washed out of programs unnecessarily because the handlers are too proud to go learn something new.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Our ego, and I've said it, you know, I stole this from HITS Canine, which is the handler instructor training seminar, is an ego is a big burden for a dog to bear. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's our ego. I just talked about it on one of the last podcasts I recorded about making mistakes, and we're human. We make mistakes every day, and we expect our dogs not to. Like, how is that fair?
So right.
It's our ego. It's our ego that gets in the way.
And we've all been there. Like, I've gotten pissed off at my dogs way too much, way too often, especially early on. I'm not immune to it. I'm like everybody else. You know, you want something so bad. You know, there's some days you go out there and you're just like, this is simple. I know you're capable of it. Maybe it's something you've seen the dog do 100 times and it's just a bad day, right? You know, I've been there, but that, to me, that's the difference in an experienced handler. When they can control those emotions, you never do anything out of anger. And that's also the value of a training partner, right? Like, if your partner in the field with you or watching or helping you doesn't have the backbone or the confidence to say, hey man, you know, put the dog up. You know, you're getting a little rough. You're getting a little too loud. Like, you're getting angry. Like, just put the dog up. Maybe come back in 15 minutes, right? Like, hit reset. You need a better training partner, or maybe you're just, you're too much of a control freak. Like, you're getting in the way of the dogs. You're getting in the way of your training partner, what have you. Either way, all of this to say is control your emotions, because that feeds down the leash. Your dogs pick up on that. And if you're getting pissed off, whatever pissed you off is only going to get worse by you getting pissed off. You just start, we just start getting in this cyclone of pissed off, and you can't escape it until you go put the dog up. And so it's like, let's just go do that before we do some damage between this relationship between me and my dog.
Yeah. And I talked about this, you know, that's one of the things from my training and experience and handling professionally. And that's been a blessing for my hounds. I have learned patience.
Yeah.
I have learned that I can do more damage in that emotional state where the dog's not performing like I want him to, or maybe my ego gets a little a hold of me. And I can do more damage in 2 minutes what it takes me 2 months to go back and fix. And yeah. Again, just like you said, that's not talking about the damage it done between the bond with you and that dog. So having those patience, being able to control, being able to police yourself and say, all right, I feel my back of my neck getting hot. I know my ears are getting red. I need to take a time out. The dog, just put him up. And I mean, I'm telling you, Nick, I've told my guys, put him in a car. Just go put him in a car. And they're like, I'm like, nope, put him in a car. We're done.
Yeah. Yep.
Take 15, take 30. We'll reset and come back. And in the long run, being able to catch yourself, or like you said, have somebody to help you catch yourself, is going to do you more good than harm.
Absolutely. And I don't want it to sound like, if anybody's listening to this, like, oh, you know, he's just one of those people that everything has to be positive with the dogs. Not everything is sunshine and rainbows. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, I'm really enjoying this kind of reward-based structure with the dogs, but also, you know, I don't have a problem with compulsion training when is necessary, right?
Like, and it's fair.
When it's fair. And, you know, but the dog has to know it. It has to be fair, because if not, like, I've seen it to where you just start chipping away at that dog. You know, there's only so many moments and of unfairness that that dog's going to take before it shuts down. And I think a lot of people misconstrue dogs shutting down as compliance, as giving in, right? And it's just like, no, I've seen some guys to where, like, ah, finally I got through to the dog because it just stopped doing whatever it was doing. It's like, nah, that dog just has no idea what the hell you want them to do right now.
And doing nothing's safer.
Yes, doing nothing is safer than doing anything else to piss you off in this moment. And, you know, it's compulsion plays a part. You know, the dog is going to eventually figure out and test you on whether or not you're going to allow him to get away with something. They're like little children. They're eventually going to test you. Maybe they're not in the mood to do something right then. So if you only train your dog with treats and positive reinforcement, you're going to get that dog that only does it when you have that treat pouch on your hip. But if you do it the right way and you teach it, then you train it and then you proof it and then, you know, test it, you go down the line. That is fair to say, oh, you don't want to do it. Well, tough shit. You're going to do it. I'm going to make you do it. And to me, that's fair. But so many people just come out and from, like, you know, the first session, like, no, you're going to do this. Like, you're going to sit because I said sit. And it's like that 2-month-old puppy has no idea what sit is. It doesn't speak English. Like, let's show it. Let's teach them. And then we'll come back. There'll be a time to where if they look at you and you say sit and they don't do it, yeah, get in their butt about it. You know,
they have to understand it first.
They have to understand it. And I see so many people just washing dogs out, especially in the hound world. Like, I don't know why a lot of houndsmen think obedience in their hounds is a bad thing, right? Like, just some manners, right? Like, I had my one red bone. I didn't have a pack. So take everything I say with a grain of salt. But one thing I always enjoyed going around, this was before I knew squat about dog training, is I got compliments all the time about how well-mannered my red bone was. And it's like, it wasn't because I knew anything. It's just I spent time with him, right? Like, I just tried teaching him some things, and he took to it because he wasn't a moron. And I think so many people, especially in the hound world, when I talk to them, it's almost like they act like it's a no-no to teach your dog.
It's voodoo.
Yeah, it's like you can't teach your dog basic manners. Like, you can't go load up in the truck for me, right? You can't be quiet in the truck. Like, you know, just basic things that make our lives and everybody around us, their lives better, to not listen to your dog barking like a madman in the back of a truck. You know, you can fix that. You know, it's, you know, I don't want to be 70 having to pick up my dog and put them on the tailgate, right? I want them to load up, but there's also other ways around that, and you can show them the right way to do it. And it's all little stuff, but to me, it's all building blocks for a well-rounded relationship with your dog. And I know that can kind of get blown out to where, like, I just need a dog that does his job. I don't need a relationship. Well, okay, fair enough. You know, we have different goals. So, you know, you're obviously not the person that I'm talking to, and vice versa. There's nothing wrong with it. Go enjoy it for what it is. But if you own a hound and you think that there's no purpose in doing all that, just take your next hound puppy and put some manners on it and tell me you don't enjoy being around that dog a little bit more.
Gosh, it makes a relationship so much better. It's funny you was talking about barking dogs. I don't know where I was this past week. I had pulled in at the gas station, and I had 6 dogs in my truck. And I pulled in, and a lady come over, and she's like, she seen the noses sticking out. She's like, what do you got? And I'm like, I got a couple hounds in there. And she's like, a couple? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, how come they're not barking? I'm like, ma'am, they're not supposed to be barking. Like, you know, we don't bark unless we are involved in chasing something.
Yep.
And she was just amazed that I had six dogs in the truck and they just weren't carrying on crazy.
Just chilling.
Yeah. Like that's what they're supposed to do. But
and that right there is going to leave an impression with her to where then she goes home and tells her family members or friends eventually in passing, just like, oh, I met a houndsman at the gas station. He had six hounds and they were all just sitting there chilling. And perception wise, especially in today's day and age, as we have to care about the culture and our, and how people view us and what we like to do, you know, that goes a long way, in my opinion, to where, you know, the better mannered dogs that you have, the better other people are going to perceive us and how we treat our own dogs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, one thing leads to the next. And don't get me wrong, my dogs aren't perfect. You know, my dogs, they're dogs. Right. Just like us, we make mistakes or we just have that day where we're just, I don't want to do that. Same thing with the dogs. You know, my dogs aren't perfect, but that doesn't mean that you don't try and reach perfection. Right.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's what my podcast is about, becoming a better handler, a better houndsman, and having a better relationship with that dog. And I have learned that, you know, I preach 5 minutes a day. It takes 5 minutes a day while you're feeding, you know, while you're out, you know, whatever you're doing. If you spend 5 minutes a day with your young dogs or your old dogs or whatever, that 5 minutes a day is going to put you above 90% of the population because people don't spend the time.
I'd say you're probably undershooting that with 90%. I'd say 98-99% of the population. I mean, you take your average person and their dog. Like, I love dogs. I can't stand to be around the average person's dog. Like, I can't. You know, working dogs, be it sporting dogs, hounds, you know, actual canines, what have you, anybody that actually invests the time in their dogs, I love them. I want to be around them all the time. I always have one or at least one around me. But yeah, the average person, like, they just don't do anything with their dogs. And it's just sad, honestly, because I'm looking at it. I'm like, man, like, what could be with that dog? You know, to your point, 5 minutes a day. You're not asking for much. When you go scoop that food in the pan, just think like, what kind of fun game can we do? What can I get this dog to do to get paid in its kibble, right? Yep. And like, you do that for a month and come tell me what stupid little tricks that you just played, but it's not about the stupid trick, right? Like, it's not about the dog saluting you or shaking hands. I mean, my dogs don't know very many parlor tricks by any means. It's about building that relationship. If your dog has fun with you, it's going to want to be around you more.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I preach it. When my dog, like my pups, I got pups that are 8 months old right now. I got four of them and like, I make them sit. They've went through that whole routine where when I feed them first, I make them wait. And then I make them sit and then I'll open the door to the kennel. I don't want them running over me. I'll make them wait. And then I call them out name by name and then they get their, like all those little things, like 5 minutes a day. Like it takes me 30, 40 minutes to feed and get my chore, you know, feed, clean pens, water. I've got it down to a science, but while I'm doing that, I'm also doing those other little things.
And
it makes, like I said, it makes the relationship better. It makes hunting more enjoyable being out there with them because I'm not screaming and yelling all the time, you know, repeat. No, I say it one time. Most time when I say it, we've been through the process. We've been through the training regimen. Yeah. We've been through the little details and we've been through the little step-by-step things and it just makes it enjoyable. But, you know, you and I are a lot alike. Like I want to shape and mold that dog into what I want. And I love seeing that progress. I love seeing that development.
It's addicting. It really is addicting. I, you know, my older short hair, she's 10, 11. Again, me with details, that she's 10 or 11, somewhere in there. You know, she's still hunting hard and everything. So hopefully, knock on wood, I have, you know, a few more quality seasons with her. But it was just in the past year or two that I hit what I call autopilot. When you get that dog to the certain point that you just get to go out and you truly get to unplug and just enjoy the hunt. What she wants, I want. She knows what I'm thinking. I know what she's thinking. You can about go hunt her without even a tracking collar. I don't, because of just safety reasons, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you can, and you just go on autopilot and you come back. And by the time you're back at the truck, it's like, man, I just spent 3 hours in the woods chasing rough grouse with this dog. And I didn't say a word to her. Right. Like That's the relationship I want with my dogs. And unfortunately some dogs get there faster than others, but you know, it still takes the time that it takes for each dog. And unfortunately, by the time you get there, fill in the blank of what type of dog, the time is too short for us to enjoy that. We spend so much time, 3/4 of their lives, training and building and building. I want to get to that point as fast as and as efficiently as possible so that I can enjoy those autopilot hunts with my dogs more than just on the back end of their lives. Because I don't know about you, one of my biggest pet peeves in this world is people hacking their dogs. Again, sometimes dogs need to get, you know, get a spanking from time to time, right? Like they just do. But so many people just go out and from the moment they drop the tailgate, it's just constant hacking their dogs. And it's just like, will you just shut up and let your dog hunt?
Yeah.
Like just let, you got the dog to do a job. Let it go do the job.
You know, I know that guy. I know that guy.
We all know that guy.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, and I'm like you. Drop the tailgate, the dogs load up. I don't have to say a word. Like they know, drop the tailgate. Okay, we're ready to go. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to be able to open the kennel and the dogs don't barrel through me to go out, but they just stick their head out and I put a collar on them. Then you come down and then you go hunt. Right.
Yep.
You can't, there's not a houndsman out there that can't tell me that wouldn't be nice. Like I see the hounds, they'll open it and all of a sudden they just get, you know, a face and chest full of hound, you know, 90-pound hound coming at them or something. I'm like, you know, it's not, you can literally train that in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. If that, like these dogs are smart and you know, you don't have to be wrestling with dogs on the tailgate just to collar them up.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I was letting mine out and then collaring them. And then I'd let them out and I'd be somewhere where there was bear odor and then they'd be off without a collar. So I learned my lesson the hard way. You know, I learned it the hard way. Like people fuss because my guys that I hunt with, I have to drive an hour no matter where we go to hunt. And I don't put collars on my dogs in the truck because I don't want them chewing antennas up, especially my puppies, because they're going to chew. So I wait till we get to where we're hunting. I let my dogs out. I let them clean out, collar them up. You know, then I load them up and then we hunt. And as soon as we're done hunting, like I uncollar my dogs, put them back in the truck because I don't want them chewing those antennas up.
Yeah.
I've replaced too many of them. But yes, no, I'm with you. Like, again, 5 minutes a day.
The enjoyability of the hunt, the training session goes a long way with me. This is supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be, quote unquote, you know, a hassle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every step of the way that becomes a hassle is just another barrier between you and enjoying what it is that you are actually wanting to go out there and do. And the dogs, they can be a real addition to the process, or they can be a real pain and subtraction to the experience overall. And it's not the dog's fault. It's the handler's fault. And the more we can put quality information out there and try and help people if they want it, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, go bang the drum in somebody's ear that just doesn't want to hear it. Again, we all have our own goals and preferences, but at the end of the day, I'm a believer in more valuable information out there, the better, because it just helps everybody enjoy their experiences. And again, it helps with the public perception of what we do. Not that that should be like the guiding light or factor, but man, we got to call a spade a spade. It matters in today's day and age in the culture overall. I mean, we have to be setting that example for the non-hunters, unfortunately, as much as we probably don't want to be.
Yeah, no, I think that's That's a very good analogy. And I was going to ask you before we cut it off.
Yeah.
Like what would you leave us with? And I don't know if you can top that, but if you got something, lay it on us.
Oh, I'm going to say, I mean, regardless of your target or what you hunt and chase and pursue with your dogs, try and find a way to keep it as pure and natural between the game and the dog itself, right? Like try and remove yourself from the equation as much as possible and be an observer or an outsider. Like, you know, again, it kind of falls in line with what we've already talked about in regards to the hacking and always having to inject yourself into the process. But I see, especially in the bird dog world, so many people thinking that they have to control their dogs to the point that they tell the dog when to stop and point. They say they tell the dog every single step of the way. And to me, it removes some of the, again, not to be over romantic about it, but it does remove some of the magic between it. When a pointing dog slams a point and it's staring in the eye of a rough grouse and you just see that dog just trembling, wanting to break, but it's not because he understands its job and he understands that he doesn't get that bird in its mouth unless we're involved, then we're working together as a team, right? And I think so many people go in and they inject themselves into the equation so much that the dog, honestly, that you lose that natural relationship between the bird and dog. And again, you can fill in whatever you want, coons, bears, mountain lions, or whatever, you know, don't control the hunt. We're out there because we love the hunt and everything can go a million different ways. It's random. It's never the same exact thing two times in a row. So why would you try and control it to make it the same thing every time? So yeah. That's kind of my thing is like, remember why you're out there doing it in the first place. And again, not to be over romantic, but these dogs are special. It's a true privilege to own and live with each one of these dogs. Enjoy them for what they're put on this planet to do. And that's to chase whatever game or pursuit that you're after and get out there and get after it.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Well, Nick, like I could talk for me and you could talk for days. Like yeah. I'm telling you, we on the same plane.
Yeah,
we're working it. Like we're working it, and maybe we'll do. Maybe we'll get an opportunity to continue this because this was a great conversation.
Yeah, we'll have to circle back and do an episode on my show with you at some point.
Absolutely. So thank you for helping us teach, train, and learn.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.